We're looking at Exodus chapter 20, and we're going through this particular chapter a little slower than we've done any other so far. But I think that makes sense because we're starting to look at something we haven't really looked at before. And so this is a new kind of, we'd say a new kind of genre in our Bible reading. We've been reading just story. And now we're picking up a section of the Bible that is law. And it's big, so there's a lot of it. There are we're about to read 52 laws in Exodus 20 through 24, and then there's 613 laws in Exodus through Deuteronomy. And most of us don't go around reading a list of 613 laws any time unless we have to. And this takes up a lot of the Bible. It takes up the first five books of the Bible. And a lot of the rest of the Old Testament has portions where people are talking about how much they love this section of the Bible, and then where they're actually, like you'd say, riffing on this section of the Bible. It's coming up everywhere, and it's definitely central. So if you think of Genesis through Deuteronomy as telling one story, so they're five different books, but they tell basically one story, and yet the center of this story is all these laws. So it is central to the story. It's maybe a little bit like where you're watching a movie with someone and there's parts of the movie that you really like, but they're from a different culture or something. And there's a part of the movie that you think is really boring, but they're just like totally riveted by it. And then you're kind of looking at them and thinking, oh, I wonder why you like this part of the movie so much. And and obviously the writers of the Bible, they're inspired and they like this part of the story, this part of the Pentateuch so much, and so we they're right, we're wrong, and so we need to go back and say what is going on with all these laws, because they're not only central, they're important. The rest of the Bible talks a lot about these laws. There's going to be big debates even in the New Testament about what's going on here and how they work. And this is something Paul's going to talk about in Galatians, and he gets all worked up and what is their function. And there is a big portion of the New Testament that's kind of devoted to helping us understand the law. And so we need to understand them and how they work. And it can be a little confusing because we're like reading this and thinking, are we still supposed to obey these laws today? Which one of these laws do we obey? If we're not supposed to obey them exactly, if they're not like exactly for us, what are they here for? Why are we reading them? And so we started, you remember last week, by saying we need to remember that they're part of a story. So this is a chapter. These are chapters in a story. And specifically, we're looking at a covenant God made with a nation called Israel. And so a covenant is a little bit like a contract, but bigger. It's it has to do with a relationship. You make commitments to somebody, they make commitments to you. And when we look at Exodus 20 through 24, it's kind of, if you picture it, like we're looking at wedding vows, in a sense. That's maybe a metaphor to understand what's going on here. Wedding vows between Israel and God, between the nation Israel and God. And we saw the start of the ceremony back in chapter 9. And so it's really big. Israel comes to a mountain. This whole nation is rescued from slavery, and they come to a mountain the way God said they would. So God comes to Israel months before, and he's like, I'm going to meet you at a mountain. And then Moses, and God has to go to a lot of effort to enable this nation to be able to meet him at this mountain, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere. And then Moses, when they get to the mountain, Moses goes up to God on the mountain, and God talks to Moses and basically says, this is why I brought you here. I brought you to this mountain for a specific purpose. I want you to go down. And I want you to tell the people that they know who I am now. I wanted, when you got to this mountain, for you really to know me. I wanted you to know that who I am. And that's why I rescued you the way I did. And if they'll enter into this relationship with me, I'm going to use them to change the world. Basically, he makes an offer to the people. You're going to be this special nation that's going to be living in this amazing place, and I'm going to use you to be my image to the entire world. And Moses comes down, and he's like, this is what God says he wants to do for us and what he wants from us. And the people are like, yeah, we totally accept. They don't even hear the vows yet, the specifics. They're just like, anything God says, we will do it all, every single thing. And then Moses goes up to God and tells God what the people said. And God says, okay, now we're ready. I'm going to come down from the mountain so that the people can hear me when I speak to you. But before I do, you have to get the people ready because this is going to be really dangerous. And so Moses goes down and gets the people ready. And on the third day, after he's been preparing them, there's like 600,000 of them or so. So it takes work for him to prepare them. And on the third day, there is thunder and there's lightning and there's thick clouds. And from out of nowhere, there's like the sound of these loud trumpets. And it just keeps getting louder and louder and louder and louder. And Moses brings the people out of the camp to meet with God. And the mountain, as they come towards the mountain, they're scared because Moses has been telling them, like, you got to be careful here. Like, watch your kids, because if you get too close, you're going to die. And so they can obviously get a sense of that because, like, they're hearing thunder and seeing lightning and hearing all these trumpets. And the mountain is wrapped up in smoke and the trumpet's getting louder and louder. And Moses speaks to God and God answers him in thunder. Which you can just picture, you know, speaking and then, and he calls on Moses to come out of the people up to the mountain, and Moses goes up. And when Moses goes up there, God tells him again, you need to tell the people to be careful. Like, I'm not joking. And Moses is like, but I already told them to be careful. We remember how we spent 3 days getting everybody ready. And God says, okay, go down and get Aaron. And tell the people again to be careful. And when Moses is down there this time, he goes back down the mountain. God speaks. And so Moses is with the people. God is speaking. This is Exodus chapter 21. It says, and God spoke all these words, saying. And that's the context and the story. And maybe another thing, I guess, to remember about these laws as we go into them is that there are different sets, almost, you could say. So this is Exodus 20, where God is speaking to Moses. All the people are there. And then there's going to be a break towards the end when the people are like, no, Moses, we're too scared. We don't want to be this close to God. Can you just go up to God for us? Because it's like, it's too much for us. And then Moses goes up to God there, and then there's 42 more laws that he gives in 21 through 23. And then we're going to read about the tabernacle. And then in Leviticus 17 to 26, there's another set of laws that they call like the holiness code. And then there's Deuteronomy. So it's almost like we've got these different sets of laws. One's on a tablet that God actually wrote with his finger. One's something that Moses wrote down, another's this holiness code, and then another comes way later. And those laws are brought together and patched into this story that we find in the first five books of the Bible. And when we look at these here in Exodus 20, it's okay for us to take a little longer in the Ten Commandments or the Ten Words, because they seem to have a little bit of a special place in that they come first. Before you're tired of reading all the laws, they come first. And these are the ones that are communicated directly by God. So like the rest he gives to Moses, he writes down, he teaches the people. this is all the people on Moses, and God just, I don't know if they're hearing thunder and only Moses hears it, or they all hear it specifically. They end up being preserved in stone. They're written by God's finger, and then they put them in this ark of the covenant, and then they eventually have this like tabernacle and temple, and they put the ark in the tabernacle with the tablets in there, and nobody's allowed to see them. But still, even though they're different sets in a sense, they're all part of this bigger thing that God's doing in Israel, and they're part of this special covenant that he's making with them. Though, and this is something I hadn't always realized, we're not getting all the laws of Israel when we read Exodus through Deuteronomy. So it's almost like we're getting some samples instead. And that becomes obvious when you look at the laws. As we look at the laws, you're going to see they don't speak to every single last issue. And a lot of times when they do speak, they're dealing with more unusual cases instead of the ones that you would expect them to. So one author explains, for example, how a normal marriage is to be contracted is never specified, only what should be done in cases of rape or seduction. The rules about divorce are not given. Only certain limitations on divorcees' freedom to remarry are mentioned. The laws on inheritance mention some changes when a man only has daughters, but it says nothing about when a man has sons. How the estate should be shared out between them and his widow is left unstated. Clearly, it's anticipated that the people will know what to do in these circumstances. And so it seems like as we read through all these laws, they're picking certain issues for a certain purpose that might sometimes seem a little random to us. And yet that's part of why we need to do the work and kind of put ourselves back in their shoes to see if we can understand why these laws would have been emphasized in this particular setting. And sometimes they're dealing with issues that the people were failing. Some laws are basically like, hey, this is how things always should be. And some laws are more like, this is how things are. So we're going to deal with how things are. And this is what you need to do with the reality of you guys being sinful people and living in a sinful, broken world. This is how you can take care of that without causing too much damage in the meantime. And sometimes the laws that are picked out and put here are laws that were places where Israel really needed to stand out from their neighbors. So some of the things that he picks out, we would be like, I don't quite get it. But it has something to do with the fact that they were living in this world a couple thousand years ago, where people were doing certain things connected to idolatry. And so they'll like, God will have to tell them, like, don't do that because it's a pagan way of living. And sometimes what stands out is not so much that the laws are different, but the laws that are added. So like in the Ten Commandments, there might have been some things in the Ten Commandments that even Egyptians or other people in the ancient world would have agreed with, but then those laws are standing right next to other laws that they never would have thought of, like maybe do not steal next to remember the Sabbath and only worship one God, worship God. That is definitely significant. And then there's the order. So even if we look at the 10 words, what comes first is our relationship with God, and what comes second in these laws is our relationship with others, which is kind of turning the values, the way people normally think, upside down. And then there are just some really stark differences that we're going to see as we read through these laws. One author explains, and this is one we're going to take some time to think about more probably next week. But in Exodus 21, it's kind of interesting. After we get out of Exodus 20 and the simple, the Ten Commandments, the first set of laws is actually about slavery. So that's something that just gets us right into controversy nowadays. And so we're going to talk about that. first of all, why do those laws come first? But second of all, why would there be laws about slavery here? But as we look at the laws about slavery, one of the things that we're going to see is that God's concern is very different than the concern like in Egypt or some of those other places, because he is putting laws in place for the protection of the person who was in a vulnerable situation. Also helps, it will help us, I guess I shouldn't say too much of this before we get there, but it will help us to realize that like the slavery that he's talking about is so radically different than the kind of slavery that comes into our mind when we think about slavery. So like this was a agricultural economy, and so if you're if you had a farm and your farm, you were a bad farmer and your farm didn't produce anything and you got into all kinds of debts, like you were basically done. You couldn't take, you would starve and your family would starve. And so sometimes what happened in order to help that person who was in that vulnerable position is he would go to a neighbor's farm and say, here, it's more like indentured servitude. Let us become part of your household, become part of your family in a sense, and I'll work for you so that I can pay off my debts and so that I can actually eat and my family can survive. And so that person coming into that other person's farm to live as part of their household, obviously then he would have obligations to that particular person. He wouldn't just be able to just sit there. He would have obligations. And yet God knew that people in that particular situation would be very vulnerable, and that still obviously happens today. And so God puts in instructions here in the law to make sure that the person who's like bringing these people into his household doesn't take advantage of those that are coming into his household like that, which was, like I'm saying, very, 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 very different than the way people think today, or the way people thought in that day, excuse me. I read a quote: if we still feel uncomfortable with the way the Bible speaks about slavery, it may be pointed out that it's been recently introduced in Britain and hailed as a great humanitarian innovation. And I thought, well, that's a crazy quote. What's he saying? And he says, in ancient Israel, and even to this day in poorer countries of the world, slavery is usually a consequence of debt that had been incurred as a result of personal misfortune or the result of legal damages awarded after committing an offense. Today, we usually send offenders who cannot pay their fines to prison. Then they become slaves. Recently, though, in Britain, it's starting to dawn on us how degrading and corrupting a punishment imprisonment is. So we have community service orders. People are sentenced to do X days labor for the community instead of going to prison. This is nothing but biblical slavery under a new name. Perhaps we may look forward to the day when the wisdom of other features of biblical penal policy will also be recognized in modern Britain. And really what we see in the slave laws are steps that are taken towards the elimination of any slavery as well. So the law is going to push us, and yet if we're patient, I think we're going to benefit as we study these laws, and if we're willing to do a bit of imaginative thinking. But I'm sure that we'll have a lot more time to talk about that. Let's take a few minutes and try to look at the 10 words more specifically. And last time we looked at verses 1 to 11, and maybe we can just remember what God says there. The first thing that he does is he reminds them of what he's done. That's verse 2. And so that's always important as we come to these laws. It's not God saying, okay, if you do these 10 things, I'll like you. It's actually, I rescued you, I saved you, and now here is how you can image my name to the world. Israel was going to be this people that the world looked out and said, wow, that's what it looks like to live with God as Savior and King. And God's like, I'm going to teach you how to do that now, how to be distinct. And then he lays out what that means. And first, the first thing he says is verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. And we think of that usually in terms of priority, and that's true. But you remember last week we said they thought of God as having all these other gods around him, like in a circle like this. And so here God's saying, no, don't think of me like that. I am supreme. I'm in a category all by myself. And you remember that was part of the purpose of Exodus, for them to know that. And then second, they say not to make a carved image representing God. And again, in that day, they had all these idols. That was the typical way of working. And when they had the idols, they didn't think of the idol as being all there was to God. But actually, they thought there was a God who wanted them to make this little carved creature to represent him. And then he would fill that creature with his presence, in a sense. And so they would relate to God through that image. And God says, I don't want you to make any images of me, maybe partly because God already made an image of himself. That's kind of interesting. He was going to fill the world with images of himself, if you remember. And we broke that, of course. But he later is going to send the perfect image of himself, Jesus, into the world. But those are the two first two commandments, which have to do with worship and idolatry. And that is going to become a major theme in the Bible, the danger of idolatry and the importance of worshiping God alone. And I think we didn't really do this last week, but it's good to just take just a quick minute to think, what are some ways this commandment could apply to us? Like, obviously we're not Israel, but we're seeing a little bit here what matters to God. And he wants us to not have any other gods before him and to not worship idols. How might we have other gods before God? What would be some ways we might fail to worship God alone?
Think our savings take care of us instead of God.
Right. Yes. That would be our big one, to invest money with the power of a God. To think about what it means to have a God, to worship another God, you kind of have to think about what a God is. So what is a God? What do we mean by the word God? What is something that's a God to us?
All powerful.
Power, something we see, this is the source of power.
This we're willing to make sacrifices for.
Okay, well, this is something we serve, something that has authority over us. Something we put this is what can rescue us.
Brings us joy.
Something that is going to bring us pleasure and delight. Yeah, ultimate. All in the ultimate sense.
Something we give our resources to, our time. Or
yes, right. Something we have responsibilities to, ultimate responsibilities to. Martin Luther answered this like this. He says, a God is the term for that to which we are to look for all good and in which we are to find refuge in all need. Therefore, to have a God is nothing else than to trust and believe in that one with your whole heart. As I've often said, it is the trust and faith of the heart alone that make both a God and an idol. If your faith and trust are right, then your God is the true one. Where your trust is false and wrong, there you do not have the true God. For these two belong together, faith and God. Anything on which your heart relies and depends, I say that is really your God. And so Luther says, you need to notice that the Ten Commandments begin here with who are you worshiping? Specifically, who are you relying on as God? Who do you look to for security? Who do you look to for identity? Who do you look to for hope and joy, ultimately? That's your God. And he says, this is put at the beginning because that's the fundamental problem. Like, if you don't obey this command, you can't obey the rest of them. It's like this is the doorway into all these other commands. Like if you are not worshiping God alone, then you're breaking all the other commands. And when you break the other commands, it has to do with you first breaking this one, that you're worshiping someone other than God. I like how Luther puts it. He says, all those who do not at all times trust God and do not in all their work or sufferings, life and death, trust in his favor, grace, and goodwill, but seek his favor in other things or in themselves, do not keep this first commandment and practice real idolatry, even if they were to do the works of all the other commandments. And in addition, had all the prayers, obedience, patience, and chastity of all the saints combined. For the chief work is not present, without which all the others are nothing but mere sham, show, and pretense, with nothing back of them. If we doubt, and here's the quote, just bold print it. I know it's a lot of words, but if we doubt or do not believe that God is gracious to us and is pleased with us, or if we presumptuously expect to please him only through our works, then it is all pure deception, outwardly honoring God, but inwardly setting up self as a false savior. And so this past week we had that little podcast where they asked, can you do good if you're an unbeliever? And Luther would say, no, that's just a sham good, because you're worshiping, you're committing idolatry as you do all this other good. So it is ends up, you're trying to be your own savior, it ends up being disgusting. He says, not believing that we're accepted by God because of Jesus and looking somewhere else is idolatry. It's worshiping a God other than a true God. And that's a big problem, because if you're doing that, then you won't keep the other commandments either. It's a sin underneath other sins. So it's always good to ask yourself, what is the sin underneath this sin? So like, why do I lie? Well, usually I lie because I'm committing idolatry. I am I'm worshiping myself and I want others to have that same view of me. Or I think I can rescue myself through my own words from the trouble that I've placed myself in. So you don't just stop lying by saying, stop lying. You stop lying by repenting of idolatry. I need to stop looking to myself for salvation, and I'm going to trust that God is for me. And so I don't need to use my words to try to get other people to approve of me and to worship me. My life is about worshiping God, so I can tell the truth in this moment and give glory to God by telling the truth. So the Bible, this is Tim Keller, does not consider idolatry to be one sin among many or a rare sin found only among primitive people. Rather, all our failures to trust God wholly or to live rightly are at root idolatry, something we make more important than God. There's always a reason for sin. Underneath our sins are our idolatrous desires. And idols lie. That's the thing. That's what's so sad about worshiping an idol. Anytime you make something other than God the place where you're looking for power, security, approval, identity, that thing's going to disappoint you. Like, we look at primitive people worshiping a little piece of wood and we're like, guys, that's not going to rescue you. But God looks at us worshiping money and he's like, do you realize, or worshiping our own pleasure? And he's like, you realize by worshiping your own pleasure, you're losing pleasure. Like, you put anything in the place of God, it can't be God. And so it ends up disappointing you. I often think about that with like anger, you know, like when you get angry, what are you trying to be? You're trying to be God. And yet, does it ever work when you try to be God? Does anger really actually accomplish what you think it can accomplish? No, usually what it does, sinful anger, is just produce damage. And so anytime you put something in the place of God, it's not able to be God really for very long. So those are the first two commands, and we already looked at them, and I've taken up most of our time already. But then the third, he says, let's look at the third one just real quickly. Verse 7, it says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, which we usually think of as like cursing. But it's actually bigger than that. So this is, we apply this to speaking, but you know, the actual Hebrew word here is a little weird. It's carry. So it's like, you shall not carry the name of the Lord your God in vain. Or like the other way would be bear. The other word would be bear. You shall not bear God's name in vain. And so you have to kind of interpret that and think, what is that talking about? What does it mean to carry God's name in vain? And so this is a little bit like a mind blown for me at least. But one scholar explains, he says, most assume that bear the name is shorthand for something like bear the name on your lips, which would be to say the name, or lift your hand to the name, which would mean to swear an oath. But there's a much simpler explanation, so wait for it. This is kind of cool. We miss it because it involves a metaphor that's unfamiliar to us. So right after God gives the Ten Commandments here, later God's going to give instructions about the tabernacle. And the instructions about the tabernacle we're going to see talk about the two stones, the two tablets, and then what the high priest was supposed to wear. And so there was this special piece of clothing that the high priest was supposed to wear that had 12 precious stones on it. Maybe you remember this. And those stones were inscribed with each one with the name of one of the tribes of Israel. And then Yahweh instructs Aaron to bear the names of the sons of Israel whenever he enters the tent. So Aaron literally bears their names. He carries them on his person as he goes about his official duties. He serves as the people's authorized representative before God. And then he also bears Yahweh's name on his forehead, setting him apart as God's representative to his people. Now, Aaron was a high priest and he was really special, but he was kind of like a picture of what all of Israel was supposed to do. So you remember God at Mount Sinai said, Israel, you are going to be my kingdom of priests. You're going to be my official representative. You are going to represent me to the nation. And so this scholar says, by selecting the Israelites, Yahweh has claimed them as his own, in effect, branding them with his name as a claim of ownership. Because they bear his name, they're charged to represent him well. That is, they must not bear that name in vain. This goes far beyond oaths or pronunciation of God's name. It extends to their behavior in every area of life, in everything they represent him. They are his public relations department. The nations are watching the Israelites to find out what Yahweh is like. And then she says, not convinced yet? Look at Aaron's blessing in number 6. After Aaron is ordained as a high priest, clothed with those special garments, the tabernacle is consecrated. His first official act was to pronounce blessing over the people. And this is what he said. He said, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh smile on you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh show you his favor and give you peace. But right after that, listen to this. The next verse says, so they will put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them. So Aaron has these clothes where he's got Yahweh's name on his forehead and the 12 tribes on his chest. And then God says he's blessing. His first act is to bless the Israelites and put God's name on them. And it was like they wore basically, it was like the Israelites were wearing an invisible tattoo. Yahweh, and they were not to bear that name in vain, which I think is really cool, really good. And then the next command was remember the Sabbath day, and they were to do that by resting. And so the world, that was the world was to look at Israel and see God's purpose for the world, and it was like they were to get a glimpse of the future, and God's good plan for the world involves rest. That's where he's taking it. And then verse 6, we didn't really mention this, but it says at the end of, actually verse 10, I don't know why I said verse 6, but at the end of verse 10, it says in the middle there, the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who's within your gates. And so here's the head of the house. He's got all these people that he's responsible for. And what is he teaching the head of the house? He's saying, you need to make sure your whole house has one day where they chill. Like, you can't just be running everybody for your own gain. No, it's important as the head of the house that you honor me by making sure that everyone in your household takes a day to rest. And so really he's telling them, you need to, as the leader, you need to seek their good, seek the people's good. And then he goes on, finally, verse 12. What time is it? Oh, wow.
Sure. So do you think that, so they were going to work before the fall. Do you think that they still would have had a day of rest?
you know, in 6 days, and then the rest. It's definitely easy in a synchronous world to imagine the need for rest before the fall. Do you think they would have rested in some way, like?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Okay.
I don't know that there's an answer. There's kind of little debates about it.
Okay.
Some people talk about the seventh day as that it was almost like, because it's different. It doesn't say the seventh day ends differently than all the other 6 days.
Right.
So that some people would say the picture is that it was just to be rest from that.
From then on.
From that point on.
In their work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then this would be a progression, that principle, in a sense, to
yes.
the synchronous world.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well. And then specifically, he, after talking about the responsibility really of the head to the home, like you need to make sure that the family rests, then he talks about the responsibility of those under the head, those that they have to the ones in position of authority. And specifically, he says, verse 12, Bailey, you want to read verse 12 since you're a young one?
Honor your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord is giving you.
Yeah, and so what does honor mean? What do you notice about this command? Respect, yeah, esteem, really. And what do you think that looks like? And why do you think, what do you think is significant about this command?
We went through in Colossians, the command is to obey your mother and father.
Mm.
And that is usually assumed to be just an outward thing. But
mm-hmm.
honor is an inward attitude. So
yeah.
It's deeper.
Yeah. That's right. And here he doesn't seem to be just talking about young children either. It seems to be something that's in place for all of us. And what do you think is what is the reason that he gives for showing respect and honor to the ones God placed over us in our families? Yeah, and Paul picks that up and applies that principle to us in Ephesians, right? This is the only command with a promise, he says. Well, keep going. He says, you shall not murder and you shall not commit adultery. And what does Jesus do with those particular commands? Yeah, so he says, you guys read that as just like, as long as you don't go out and kill somebody, you're fine. And as long as you don't actually literally commit adultery, you're fine. But Jesus says the command has a lot more to do with your life than just externals. It also has to do with your heart. So I say to you, if anyone gets angry, they're actually committing murder. If anyone lusts after a woman in their heart, they're actually guilty of the breaking this command as well. And then he says, you shall not steal, which teaches us what? What does that teach us just about even living in a community? It's kind of a simple, obvious command, but it tells us something about the way God looks at property in this world right now. Is that you can have personal property, like there, it all belongs to him, but there are things that can particularly belong to me that wouldn't be right for you just to take. We had, and it seems so obvious to us because it's kind of ingrained in American culture, but like we always had fun in Africa when we'd have people stay with us that were like African, and then people stay with us that were German. And they would live in the same room, and the German would go get groceries and put it in the refrigerator. And then the person who was from a different culture, he'd come back and those groceries would be gone, you know. And he would be like, wait, what just happened here? That's stealing. And then the African would be kind of like, no, what's yours is mine, and what's mine is yours, right? And he's probably thinking in the family context, we're living in a family here, but it was harder for them to understand the idea of personal property. And I think sometimes we get a little funny about it, but at the same time, it does seem like God, this would be a place where you would argue for the fact that, yeah, it is okay to have your own personal property. But then next it says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And this we normally interpret to mean what? You shall not lie. It's probably good at least to notice that that's not exactly what it says. What is it, if you're just going to look at this so technically, what is it saying? It's bearing like false witness. So you're like, oh, this is tricky, but...
It's like if you're in court and you and your neighbor have beef and then you're called as a witness and you lie on the stand, that's what it kind of feels
yeah.
like.
Yeah.
Official.
Yes, I think so for sure. So we're going to have to read the rest of the Bible to understand more specifically about all of lying in general, I think. Some people might argue that he's taking a specific case here, bearing false witness. That's actually what Calvin argues, but bearing false witness like in a court kind of setting against your neighbor and saying, okay, from that specific case, we can extrapolate, we're never to lie. Some people, though, just to get a little controversy for today, so I don't know if this is good or not, but so this is in quotes and just something to think about. So some people would emphasize here, as we look at the rest of the Old Testament, one thing you'll notice is that the rest of the Old Testament, and this is tough because it's narrative, but Rahab lied, the Egyptian midwives already lied. Somebody's done a whole book through Samuel on about 24 cases in Samuel that have to do with lying, and that 12 of them, something like 12 of them, are just almost written in an approving kind of way. And then the rest would not. So some would say the emphasis is actually on against your neighbor, where you're using your words to do harm to others, and that's the purpose of your deceiving, and that when you're using words to love your neighbor, such as Corrie ten Boom, or the midwives, or Rahab, that's not really something that the Bible, God would have actually a problem with because of this command, that you're making it a lot more hard than it has to be by bringing up sort of a technicality the Bible doesn't. But of course, the one problem with that is we can make excuses for I'm just trying to love people all the time that are not real. So it's a little tough. And the other problem with that is God is truth, and Satan is the father of lies. So there is something, as we look at the rest of the Bible, that is particularly satanic about deceiving. And maybe as we read through the rest of the law, that's part of why it's here, I'm guessing, is that he's going to give more specifics to help us understand what it looks like to obey this command. And I think later, Exodus 23:1, it will say, you shall not spread a false report. So that seems to be having something to do with lying. But, and I guess, too, if we connect lying with idolatry, it would be hard to say most lying is because, it wouldn't be hard to say, but most lying is because of idolatry. It's because we're worshiping ourselves or trying to rescue ourselves. And so, we shouldn't use our words to be our own savior. Verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that's your neighbor's. What do you think it means to covet? Like what What would be the difference between coveting? Is he saying don't desire anything that you like? You're over at your neighbor's house and you see something good. Is he saying don't desire that? What does he mean? One interesting thing about this is that it's clear even in the Ten Commandments, God, they're about more than just actions. Because here he's dealing with what's going on in your heart. But what would you tell somebody it means to actually, what's he teaching us here?
So kind of think of like in verse 4, you were talking about jealousy. In verse 5, he says that God is a jealous God.
Yeah.
You're talking about like wanting something that rightfully belongs to you, like a married spouse.
Yeah.
Versus desiring something that is definitely not yours.
Right.
So coveting seems to be talking about the negative aspect of desiring something that's definitely not yours.
Yeah. And probably involves a willingness to sin to get it. Mm.
Right.
Placing that thing above God. Yeah.
He really mentions your neighbors. You know what I mean? So it's different from like the world is so mastered this ad thing. That's different. Like, yes, it is stoking desire. We got to deal with that. And what is that? And when does that become sin? Discontentment. That's different from like, wow, I'm gonna take your phone.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, or you don't deserve that phone. I deserve it.
Yes.
Or whatever. That's very different from like what the world does with like ads.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a sense of like maybe like justice. You know, like mm-hmm. there's something wrong here. You got that wife. I want that wife. You know,
yeah.
It's a very twisted.
Yeah.
View.
Right.
Or even getting your heart set on thinking my life, I would be so much happier
right.
if my life was like theirs.
Yes.
And that. If I only had that servant.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is a good mind blown kind of moment as well. That desire, there can be a good desire. You can desire a good desire wrongly. And a lot of sin, if you look at it and you just take it out, you'd say that desire by itself is not necessarily a wrong desire. The problem is either with me desiring it or with the way I desire it. So, you know, lust in a sense is like this. There's like this lady out there that somebody should desire, her husband. But you're saying I get to desire her. And so you look at the desire by itself and say, okay, that's a right desire. For somebody to desire that lady is fine in God's eyes. I'm just not the one for it. Like, that's not my desire. That's somebody else's desire. Somebody else gets to have that desire, not me. That's part of the problem with living in the world that we live in today, because the world we live in today is like every desire gets to be yours. And so it's confusing. But it's like, no, you don't get to have every desire. Like, there are certain desires that are not yours. And so part of living a holy life is realizing, no, that's a good desire. It's good for somebody else to have it. But it's not my desire. It's God doesn't allow me to have that desire. And that's part of how I honor him. Well, 1 minute. What happens next? We got to verse 18. Kennedy, you want to read 18 through 21? Okay, so there's a lot here, but basically God comes and speaks, and the people are scared to death. They're like, you know, they could just picture them up against the wall, like trying to get as far away as they can. And they come to Moses, and they speak. They're like, no, we just want you to speak to us, not God. We're gonna die. What do you think about that? Like, was that what? How do you respond to that response? Yeah.
Right. I mean, so God is good. He loves you. He wants a relationship with you. But it's also good to say, I need a mediator between me and God.
Right.
So it's good and bad.
Yes. Right. Exactly. It's like in a broken world.
Yeah.
We're made for communion with God, but we desperately need a mediator. And then Moses, this is, I love this line. Moses said to the people, do not fear. So that's kind
stay
of...
stay away from the mountain.
Yeah, exactly. But don't be, you're not meant to be in a state of constant terror when it comes to God. So there's, but this is what he says next.
That's so cool.
God has come to test you that the fear of him may be before you. So this is an awesome line. I love the Bible. It's like, don't be afraid. God's come so that you could be afraid. You know, it's like, okay, what's going on here? But basically what he's saying is, you're not meant to be terrified, but God's let this happen like this so for your good. He's not just trying to be like a bully where it's like, oh, he just wants to beat me up. No, he's allowing you to experience this for your long-term good so that you won't sin, so that you'll remember this moment, remember that he's great, and so that you will not sin. And then the people stand far off while Moses draws near to the thick darkness where God was, which is quite a picture. And we didn't get to the end of chapter 20, but that's okay because verse 22 through 26, well, I can just summarize it. It's the next thing that he talks about is how to worship with these altars. And it's kind of different, but he's basically applying the first two commands and then saying, if you want to worship me, build an altar, but make it a simple altar. I want it to be like made of earth. And then if you're going to use stones, don't use like go crazy on the ornateness of the stones. And then when you build the steps, he says, don't build like all these steps to go up to my altar, that your nakedness be exposed on it, which is weird for us. But you just have to remember the environment in which they were living with like all these pagan altars all around them. And the fact that pagan temples were like really gross places where a lot of sexual sin was going on. And God here, the way he has them design the altar to worship, and even this little comment here at the end is saying, no, your worship of me needs to be completely distinct. You need to worship me, and you're going to need to offer sacrifices, but it's going to need to be completely distinct from the religious activity that you see around me, around you. And that's why I'm going to have to do a lot more explaining in Exodus 21 and following how that's going to work. Because they were religious. They were coming out of a religious environment. But not all religion is good. And God's saying, no, there's a certain way that you need to worship me, and I'm going to explain.
Do you think that was for temporary altars before the tabernacle?
It must have been, yeah.